Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to World Weekly with me, Gideon Rachman. This week we devote the programme to a discussion of the outside world's reaction to two crises in the Middle East, in Syria and Iran. Joining me in the studio are the FT's defence correspondent James Blitz and our energy editor Javier Blas, and on the line from Washington, Jeff Dyer, one of our correspondents there. Jeff, there's a lot of talk, I know, in Washington about the prospect of conflict with Iran, but for the moment, is that being displaced by this gathering crisis in Syria? Which is commanding more attention?
Well, I think they're both commanding equal attention. I mean, if you listen to the Republican debate last night, you saw that these were the two, and really only two, foreign policy issues that were that people seem to be interested in. But there has been a very, very intense public debate about what to do about Syria, quite an emotional debate in lots of ways in this country. But also the Iran issue is constantly on the front burner, and we're having the Israeli Prime Minister here in a couple of weeks, I think will bring potentially that issue even more to the forefront.
On Syria, is there much appetite for American intervention? I get the sense that President Obama and his administration are pretty hesitant. What's the public mood?
The public mood is very much in favour that something should be done. Constant video on the television about these horrific scenes from homes and other places around, other cities around Syria, seeing all the artillery bombings. And there is just this building public mood that something should be done. But in the administration, there are I imagine, some people who are pushing for a greater form of engagement from the administration. But it does seem that the Pentagon, at least, is very reluctant. There were some very strong statements at the weekend from General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying that this really wasn't the right time. We didn't know who we were dealing with in terms of the Syrian opposition, and this just wasn't the sort of situation that the U.S. should be getting into.
James, you're covering this meeting of the Friends of Syria and Tunis and the situation generally. There is, we've heard, this call for something to be done. What's your best bet on what actually will be done?
I think very little in terms of military or quasi-military options. I think the view is that, in marked contrast to Libya last year, there simply is no appetite for any kind of military action or arming of the rebels in any way. The situation in Syria is far more complex, as everybody knows, and in particular, you've got the situation that both Russia and Iran are giving pretty firm support to the Assad regime. So any kind of intervention immediately opens you up to a much wider set of challenges than you had in Libya. I think the focus for Friends of Syria on Friday is going to be to get the Syrian opposition to be much more coherent and vocal and declaratory about what they want to see happening. Although it's now 1 year since the Syrian uprising began, there's a strong sense that the Syrian opposition groups really haven't come together properly and effectively. There aren't clear leaders, and they don't have a sufficiently strong relationship with the Syrian opposition on the ground inside the country. And so that, I think, is where there's going to be an important emphasis. But this is very incremental stuff compared to what we saw in Libya last year. There's just no sense that it can go any further than that for the time being.
And are the Western governments clear in their own mind that Assad has to go, or is there some, at least, anxiety about what might replace him?
Well, I think the declared position of all Western governments, the US, the UK, most of the Europeans, is that Assad has to go, that we are past the point where he could possibly stay. I think beyond that, there are two points. The first is, it's not absolutely certain that he will go. I think the view inside the British government, for instance, the one that's been given to David Cameron, is there is still a, as somebody put it to me, a 15 to 20% chance that he will ride out this whole thing in the same way that the Iranians rode out the 2009 rebellion against the Khamenei leadership. So that's one thing. And I think, secondly, there is a concern that if you did see a complete implosion inside Syria and you saw the civil war escalate to new levels and you effectively saw Assad going and crisis, it's very uncertain whether that would be in Western interests at the end of the day. You would see such huge inter-ethnic conflict. You would see all the countries surrounding Syria involved, Turkey, Iraq, Israel, and so on. And of course, there is one other thing as well, which isn't talked about enough, which is that Syria does have considerable chemical weapon stocks. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty, rarely spoken about, but much on the minds of the securocrats in the UK and Washington, which is what actually would happen with these very considerable stocks. You don't want to see them getting out of control.
So those are the security concerns. But what about the economic concerns, Javier? I mean, above all, oil. We've seen the oil price going up and up, even at a period when the global economy isn't so strong. Does the Syria effect play into that? I've never thought of Syria as a particularly huge oil producer.
It is a small oil producer, but the European Union has imposed sanctions into Syria. The European Union was the big consumer of Syrian oil, and those sanctions have removed about 150,000 barrels a day. That, in the global context, is not a big amount of oil, but it's a reminder of the volatility of the region. And if you add 150,000 from Syria, about 250,000 that we are losing because unrest and strikes in Yemen, we have not recovered yet from the civil war in Libya. Libya produced about 1.6 million barrels a day before the war, and it's producing about 900,000, so it's about halfway. And obviously that is making the market very nervous. The market realized that we can lose supplies very easily because of the unrest in the region. And obviously that is making the situation in Iran worse, because everyone, what is assuming is, what if what is happening now in Syria, and we lost the supplies, happen in Iran, that is a much bigger producer?
So answer that question for me. I mean, it's going to happen in Iran, isn't it? Because we've imposed these oil sanctions.
I think it's going to happen before the deadline of the 1st of July. The European Union countries are going to stop buying. There's going to be about 500,000 barrels that are going to need to be replaced.
Give me an idea. What percentage of the world market is 500,000 barrels?
Well, it's a very small percentage, but at the end of the day, the global market is about 90 million barrels. So we are talking about 0.5% of that. But it's the marginal barrel of oil which sets the price. So even losing that, it just has a minimal impact on the market. But at the same time, it's not only the European Union sanctions. It's Washington with sanctions against the central bank of Iran, and any institution that is dealing with the central bank of Iran. The central bank of Iran is processing all the payments of oil. So it means that countries such as Japan, South Korea, even India and China are moving to reduce the amount of oil that they are buying from Iran. And when you reduce the amount of oil that you buy from Iran, you have to go elsewhere to buy it and pay a price, and that usually is Saudi Arabia.
So what are we looking for in terms of the oil price and in the knock-on effect on the global economy? Is this a real threat to global economic health, do you think?
I think it is a real threat to global economic growth. This week in London, we have had what is called the International Petroleum Week. That is the biggest gathering of the industry, particularly the oil traders here. And I spoke at the beginning of the week with Beetle, that is the largest independent oil trading house. It's very little known outside the oil industry, but it's a huge trade. That it just Beetle trades enough oil to supply at the same time France, Italy, and Germany all together. And the chief executive was telling me that he sees $120 as the new floor for the market, and he thinks that it's unlikely, but it is possible, that we will see oil prices going above the record of 2008 of $150. But you have to remind that at the end of the day, what matters for consumers here in Europe is the price in local currency, in euro and sterling pounds. And in those currencies, the oil price is already at a record high. It's more expensive today to buy a barrel of oil in sterling pounds or euros than it was at the peak in 2008.
And Jeff, of course, this is just with sanctions, but there is the threat, more and more talked about, of actual armed conflict between Iran and maybe Israel, maybe even a wider conflict involving the US and Europe. Give me a sense of the state of the debate in Washington. I mean, Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, was sort of let it be known off the record, on the record, that he thinks that there's a likelihood that Israel will attack in the coming months. How seriously is that view shared?
Well, definitely there's been a change in the atmosphere here. Almost everyone who's been to Israel in the last few months has come back with these rather alarming stories saying that the Israelis really are very serious this time, and they're not just bluffing, and there's a very good chance it's going to happen. But there are other things involved here as well. I mean, the curious thing about this sort of drumbeat for war is that the administration itself is being so publicly opposed to it. You had comments from General Dempsey again at the weekend. You had the head intelligence officer, James Clapper, last week going to the Hill and saying that they still don't think that any decision has been made by the Iranians about whether to pursue a nuclear bomb. And the curious thing about that, those comments from Liam Panetta you were talking about, is that while all the attention went on his comments saying that Israel could bomb in the spring, the other thing that he allegedly said in this to this journalist was that the U.S. would not assist Israel in any shape or form. So it's almost as if it was a public warning to the Israelis, don't try and drag us into this because we're not going to help. So if there is a drumbeat to war, it's one that, you know, publicly and in private, Washington is resisting very much.
How does the presidential election play into it, though?
Well, on the one hand, three of the four Republican candidates do seem to be in favor of, if not explicitly bombing Iran tomorrow, a much more aggressive posture towards Iran, Ron Paul being the exception. And the debates and the campaign is providing a kind of sounding board for these types of views in a way that you wouldn't necessarily have otherwise. Yet at the same time, as Javier was saying, one of the big economic risks, maybe the central economic risk facing the U.S. now, is oil prices, given that the euro situation seems to be a little bit more stable than it was a few months ago. So maybe the big risk, one of the big economic risks for President Obama, is that oil prices really spike up, and that stifles, that smothers the kind of nascent recovery we're seeing in America at the moment. So he's walking a very, very kind of narrow tightrope at the moment. On the one hand, he's trying to show the Israelis that he's very serious about pressure on Iran, he's serious about these sanctions, he's trying to persuade them not to bomb Iran. Yet at the same time, they're trying not to push the sanctions so hard that it will cause oil prices to spike and stifle the recovery in the economy.
James, we have heard all of this before. I mean, I think probably for a decade now there's been this sort of on-again, off-again debate about will Israel bomb, will Iran get the bomb, and so on. But it does feel to me a little bit different this year, more intense, more serious. Is that your impression?
Yes, there's no question that it is. There's no question that, as Jeff has said, that people that have been to Israel or when they've met Israelis who've come to Europe and the US take the view that Israel is being pretty serious about the idea of an attack this year. It does so because of this issue we haven't discussed, which is the idea that the Iranians are moving their capability, their uranium enrichment capability, into what Ehud Barak, the defense minister, calls this zone of immunity, which therefore cannot be attacked. And that is the thing that is worrying. That said, I think there are a number of issues that also need to be taken into account. Something we haven't mentioned, first of all, is that there's a whole new phase now into which this debate is going, and that is negotiations. We're going to be seeing the US and its allies and world powers, Russia, China, Britain, France, Germany, entering into a negotiation with Iran in the next few weeks and months to see whether the Iranians will make the key confidence-building concessions. Cannot be completely ruled out that they will. The pressures on them are so great. And so we need to see what's going to happen. Of course, while all those talks are going on, it's very difficult for the Israelis to act. They'll be seeing negotiations happening in Istanbul, Vienna, Geneva, probably in the next few months. And so that is going to slow things down in terms of timetables. The one thing that's absolutely clear is that the international community does not have the time it had in 2009 to watch the Iranians going into this merry dance over talks. If the Iranians are going to make a concession, it's got to be in the next 6 months. It's got to be a serious confidence-building one. And that is the thing one's now got to wait to see whether that happens.
Javier, what's the attitude in the Gulf? Because we hear a lot about Israeli pressure, but the Saudis are pretty scared of the idea of an Iranian bomb, and according to WikiLeaks, even seem to be putting pressure on the Americans to attack.
Well, we know that the private attitude on Saudi Arabia is that in reality they would love that Israel bombs, carpet bombs Tehran and sends the regime just down. Obviously, what is happening, Saudi Arabia is producing as much oil as has produced in 30 years. It's wrapping almost record high prices. So from an economic point of view, if you are sitting in the treasury or the government of Kuwait, Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, this is a fantastic windfall. They are producing lots of oil. They're taking a lot of money out of it. Don't forget also Russia. Russia is one of the countries who is benefiting the most from an economic point of view of what is happening. Russia is the second largest oil producer. It's selling massive amount of oil at almost at a record high, and it's selling it at a very high price. So it is very similar to the economic expansion that we witnessed in 2007, 2008 in Russia when prices were at record levels. And this is obviously playing very, very, very nicely for Vladimir Putin going into elections this year. But the attitude, however, is one of concern of how the European Union and the US have walked into these sanctions and how much oil is going to be removed from the international market and the potential for things getting out of control, oil prices rocketing to plus $150. And that on the long term is something that Saudi Arabia doesn't like because they want to keep oil around $100. But just adding to what James was adding in terms of the climate, to the oil traders and oil executives have been talking this week. They think that the current situation on the oil market and the geopolitics of the Middle East is very much the same that we have in late 2002, ahead of the war with Iraq. It's just that kind of sentiment that we are heading to something that is going to be very damaging for the oil market, and that is almost a sentiment that no one can stop it. And that's why the market is getting a bit carried away, and we are seeing these prices going up because a lot of people on the oil market seem to believe, well, we were already here. This is around September of 2002, and we know what happened 6 months later.
Jeff, in Washington, perhaps I'll finish with you then. This, we heard from Javier this sense amongst oil traders, at least, a sense that nobody can stop it, but is that the feeling in Washington? Because you mentioned a couple of times the Pentagon, the intelligence community, the people who will be, after all, be called upon to fight, very much appearing to be unwilling and trying to hold things back.
Well, I think, as James was saying, that you know the key next phase is how this whole negotiation proposal pans out. You know, the Iranians have now come back and said they are potentially willing to talk. So, you know, there are lots of consultations going on. We'll get some sort of sense in the next few weeks as to how that is going to progress. The problem is there's the space for these negotiations, the political space is narrowing. There's particularly in this country, there's so much skepticism about Iran and its intentions and what it really is up to that it's going to be very hard for the administration to really embrace this negotiation track wholeheartedly. It's going to come under a lot of political pressure. And underlining that, there's still a lot of confusion as to what really is the ultimate point of the sanctions. I mean, publicly, the sanctions are there to try and encourage, propel the Iranians to take negotiations seriously. But yet some people see that actually they should have a different view. The sanctions should be really enforced very rigidly and really be used as a weapon to try and force regime change, to try and encourage the opposition movement to take the streets in Iran again and to try and have another heave to push the regime out. And those are two fundamentally contradictory objectives. You can't really have them too. You can't be trying to push the regime out at the same time as force them to negotiate. So there's a kind of lack of clarity behind what the point of the sanctions is as well, which is creating a lot of confusion, a lot of uncertainty, and adding to this geopolitical tension.
Well, I'm sure we'll return to it in the coming weeks. Jeff Dyer in Washington, thank you very much indeed. And thanks also to James Blitz and Javier Blas here in the studio in London. That's it for this week.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.